In the Gospel of John, we hit this sort of moment where Jesus then gives this long discussion with the apostles, and it begins at the Last Supper. And as Mark noted a couple weeks back, during this Last Supper in John's account, there's two really interesting people that you can come and watch. You can watch Peter, and you can watch Judas. And so in Mark, you're giving the sermon sort of talking about Peter and what Peter's doing at that time. And then sort of what we want to pick up now is sort of the story of the other guy there that's sort of interesting, and this guy Judas. So let's turn to John, Gospel of John. Chapter 13. So you can imagine they're all sitting around at the Last Supper, and there's Jesus, there's the 12 apostles, they're all sitting there having dinner, you know, they're chit-chatting or so on, and Jesus begins to talk about things, he'd wash their feet and so on, and then in John chapter 13, verse 21, after he'd said this, Jesus was troubled in spirit and testified, "I tell you the truth, one of you is going to betray me." His disciples stared at one another, at a loss to know which one of them he meant. One of them, the disciple whom Jesus loved, was reclining next to him. Simon Peter motioned to the disciple and said, "Ask him which one he means." Leaning back against Jesus, he asked him, "Lord, who is it?" Jesus answered, "It is the one to whom I will give this piece of bread when I have dipped it in the dish." Then dipping the piece of bread, he gave it to Judas Iscariot, son of Simon. As soon as Judas took the bread, Satan entered into him. "What you are about to do, do quickly," Jesus told him. But no one at the meal understood why Jesus said this to him. Since Judas had charge of the money, some thought Jesus was telling him to buy what was needed for the feast, or to give something to the poor. As soon as Judas had taken the bread, he went out, and it was night. And we have here this image, right, of Judas sitting there. Jesus says, "Someone's going to betray me," and then you say, "Well, who is it?" And then they give Judas the bread, and then Jesus looks at Judas and says, "What you're going to do, do quickly." It's like Jesus read Macbeth, right? You know, so what you're going to do, do quickly here. And then Judas flees out, and then he goes, and he betrays him, and so on. And you get this picture of Judas here, and it's not hard in reading the Gospel of John to know what does John think about Judas. John is not a big Judas fan, right? And it shows up straight through the book. Flip back to chapter 6. Back in chapter 6, Jesus is talking to a larger crowd. And in John chapter 6, verse 70, then Jesus replied, "Have I not chosen you, the 12? Yet one of you is a devil." And then John adds, "He meant Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, who, though one of the 12, was later to betray him." And, you know, that's where we get this sort of thing. And then you go forward, John chapter 12. We get this scene where this woman has just been anointing Jesus with this sort of precious perfume. And in John chapter 12, verse 4, but one of the disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. "Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages." He did not say it because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put in it. And, you know, and then we go on, chapter 13, right? Chapter 13, up towards the beginning of it, right? Verse 2, the evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. And then a little bit later, you know, we sort of, Jesus is talking. Verse 10, Jesus answered, "A person who had a bath only needs to wash his feet, the whole body's clean. And you are clean, though not every one of you. For he knew who was going to betray him, and that is why he said not everyone was clean." And then we get this other Jesus saying going to betray him. And then we go forward to the arrest of Jesus in John chapter 18. Jesus is in the garden, he's praying. John chapter 18, verse 2. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew that the place where Jesus was, because Jesus had often been there with his disciples. So Judas came to the grove, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. Jesus, knowing all this was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said. And then, parenthetical aside, and Judas the traitor was standing there with them, as if you'd forgotten that Judas the traitor. You notice it's almost like this tick John has. He says, oh, they're Judas the traitor. Judas, the guy who's going to betray Jesus. He just can't help himself, right? He thinks of Judas, and he immediately has this visceral, like, you know that terrible person, Judas. John doesn't like Judas at all. And you can imagine he's writing this gospel, and every time he comes across him, he just can't. Judas the betrayer. Judas the traitor. Judas the traitor. But you know what? John's not alone. Judas doesn't have a lot of friends, it turns out. Dante, when Dante goes and makes his tour of hell and the purgatory in heaven, Dante finds Judas in hell. And where is Dante in hell? Well, you get to the very bottom of the inferno, the very bottom. And at the very bottom, there's Satan encased in ice. And Satan has three heads, right? And in each of the head, Satan is chomping on someone, like these horrible, horrible people. And two of the people he's chomping on, right, are Brutus and Cassius, the guys who had betrayed Julius Caesar. And they're both sitting there, and he's chomping on, their heads are hanging out, and they're bleeding, you can imagine. But Judas is in the third head. Judas is also being chomped on, but his head is in the mouth. He's actually reversed around. So he gets to spend all of eternity in the mouth of Satan, in there, just getting mad at what his view is, right? Being chomped away. But that's not even the worst. His back is being constantly flayed by the claws of Satan, right? So we have this. I mean, Judas does not make out well here in the afterlife, right? You want the ultimate kind of worst person in all of human history, and here's Dante saying, it's Judas. He's worse than Brutus and Cassius, right? And then you go forward and you start imagining this. Imagine you have some friends that are going to have a kid, right? And you say, oh, what do you think about naming the kid? And they say, oh, I'm going to name the kid Judas. I mean, what would you think if you imagine some of our interviewers saying, I'm going to name my kid Judas? And you to me, I say, who would name their kid Judas? I mean, you think about the worst possible name to name somebody. And it turns out for a long time, like, nobody is named Judas. Like, there's nobody named Judas. There's been this sudden, strange uptick in the last few years. There's actually now a few people every year in the United States named Judas, right? And it's sort of puzzling. Like, why is there this sudden popularity? Popularity here means, like, eight kids named Judas, right? But why is this? So I was talking about this with my family in the car driving home one night. And so Janet and Claire are there. And Claire pipes up, and she knew the answer. Lady Gaga has a recent song out, right? Came out a few years back. The title of the song is I Love Judas, right? And so you imagine sort of Lady Gaga plays the song I Love Judas. You can also now feel bad for Lady Gaga, right? Lady Gaga has been trying so hard to shock everyone for so many years. And let's be honest, in the modern world, it is hard to shock people, right? I mean, what do you have to do to really shock people? So then she has to descend to, I know what I'll do. This will really shock people. I'm going to sing a song titled I Love Judas, and maybe that'll really shock people. It tells you about Judas's reputation, that this is sort of where she's at, right? That this is her idea. The song is terrible, by the way. But anyway, so she sings this sort of song. The other nice note about this is when we were having this conversation in the car, I Love Judas, I instantly realized would be the world's best sermon title. So I said, hey, I'm going to name the title I Love Judas. And Janet just told me in no uncertain terms that was not an acceptable title for the sermon. And I tried to assure her that nobody reads the bulletin to see the title of the sermons anyway, so nobody would notice and it'd be a great joke and I'd laugh. But then, of course, Julie read the bulletin. So it's probably a good thing we didn't do that. But we sort of have this problem of Judas. If you want to go out and think of some horrible, terrible person, right? You're writing a novel and you want to signal bad guy, you name him Judas. Imagine you're making the movie of this story of Jesus' life. And you're going to cast Judas here. And you're going to put Judas in there. And first thing you want to think is like, okay, so Judas, we know he's a bad guy. What's his motive, right? We want to really get into Judas here. Why is Judas betraying Jesus? And Scripture is strangely silent on this. We have no idea from Scripture. So you start running through all the possibilities. And you start thinking, well, why would Judas want to betray Jesus? There's all sorts of theories about this. One is this, right? Judas starts hanging out with Jesus. Judas looks at the Roman Empire. He doesn't like the Roman Empire. There's a lot of Jews at the time who don't like the Roman Empire. He's imagining Jesus is going to be a king, and he's going to go overthrow Rome. And after 3 years of hanging out with Jesus, he begins to realize, this guy is never going to do that. And he says, the heck with it, and he betrays him, right? Another possibility, he's terrified of the Roman Empire. And Jesus, after 3 years, begins to realize maybe he's provoking the Roman Empire. And he's really scared that Rome might clamp down. And so he betrays Jesus for that. Another possibility, he's hanging out with Jesus. He kind of likes Jesus. He's kind of this nice guy and he's soft. But then over time, there's more and more of this God talk. Jesus starts making all these things. And maybe Judas is like, you know, this talk of God, that's just too much. And so he's going to betray him. Maybe Judas is just greedy, right? He just likes money so much. And he gets offered 30 pieces of silver, and he says, done, right? I mean, what could be better than 30 pieces of silver? Maybe he's jealous of Jesus. Maybe he's just evil incarnate, right? I mean, as you're sort of imagining this guy, and you start picturing these motives, and you start picturing him in your movie, right? It's not hard to imagine how he comes out in your movie. He's that guy off to the side a little bit, right? He's kind of scowling a little bit. He sort of doesn't seem like he's right there. You know, you're just sort of waiting for this moment he's going to do his grand evil deed. You see this in all the art of the apostles, right? You can always find Judas in the great paintings of the 12 apostles, right? Some cases, really helpful. He's the only one without a halo, right? You know, you're looking around, everyone's got a halo, and there's this one guy, no halo. You're like, ah, it must be him, right? But in others, when they don't all have their halos on, right? You know, you sort of get these pictures, and it's like there's this outdoor scene, and everything's lit. Da Vinci does this. It's indoors, but everybody's sort of lit. And there's this one guy who looks like he's in shadow, right? Who's the guy in shadow, right? You know, you sort of imagine these sort of pictures of him, and he's always this guy who's just not quite there. He's sort of set aside. He's really a bad, mean, nasty person, and we know he's a bad, mean, nasty person. And there's something really fascinating about this image we all have of Judas, because one thing we know for certain of this image we have of Judas is it has to be wrong. This cannot be what Judas was like. And we don't need to look any further than this. Imagine you had a small group of people, and you're all hanging out, right? And you've got some money coming in. And you say, who should be the treasurer of our little group? Who do we want to hold the money bag? You don't say, hey, let's pick the aloof guy over there who's always scowling and seems kind of evil, and we'll give him all the money, right? I mean, you don't pick that guy. Who do you pick to be the treasurer of your organization? Well, you pick the guy who seems most noble and upright, the most trustworthy guy, right? That's the one you want to pick to hold the money bag. And here he is for 3 years holding the money bag. And then you imagine sort of we're sitting at the Last Supper, and Jesus says, one of you is going to betray me. And in your movie, you all know what happens in your movie. Jesus says, one of you is going to betray me. Cut shot to Judas going, like, did you know? And then cut shot to everyone looking like, turning like, oh, it must be that guy there. He must be the one. And then you can imagine, you know, Bartholomew leaning and saying, I knew it all along. I told you it was him, right? That's not at all what they do. They all look stunned, right? Who could it be, they ask. Is it Bartholomew, or is it Nathaniel, or is it Philip, or is it John? I don't even know which one of Judas, throughout 3 years of hanging out with this guy, sends off no signals to any of these people. I am the guy who's going to betray you. He fits right in with this crowd year after year, day after day, with people that sort of spending all this time with him. And we have this sort of problem then. We want to think of Judas because we know how the story turns out. We want to cast him as this great evil figure, right? We want him to be the Dr. Doom of the Bible. And you know Dr. Doom is bad as soon as he shows up, right? But he's not the Dr. Doom. He's just one of the regular guys sort of hanging out here. And you imagine then, what do we do with this picture? And we can flip the picture a little bit. Imagine this. Imagine we had a church, right? It's a church of mine, right? So we got a church. But imagine in our church, the 12 apostles are in your church. You could call that the church of the 12 apostles. And in fact, you can imagine this is your church. You've got all 12 apostles coming to your church. The advertising for your church is great. Other churches may have crazy professors giving sermons, right? But we got the 12 apostles here, right? Other people may have other people that are pretty good, but we got the 12 apostles at our church. Somebody comes to your church, you say, hey, look, these are the guys handpicked by Jesus, right? He was sort of roaming around. He picked 12 people, and they're all right here at this church. What an awesome church we have. Look, we got 12 apostles, 12 of them. Everybody else has zero apostles, none of them. We must be awesome. But then you imagine who's at your church. Judas is at your church. So a stranger comes in, or you get a visitor, and you say, hey, look, welcome to Stony Brook. Here's our treasurer, Judas, right? And he's preaching this morning. We're so glad you're here to meet Judas. And we think, that just seems wrong, right? To imagine us being so happy that Judas is at our church. But Judas is one of the hand-picked people of Christ. Back in chapter 6, passage where Jesus calls him the devil, right? How does this come about? Jesus is giving this message, right? He's talking to a large group of people. And he starts giving this message about, I am the bread of life. You have to eat my flesh to be saved, right? I mean, you don't eat my flesh. And this sort of grosses everyone out. They're all people like Bailey. Like, we find this image gross, right? You know, you don't want to sit around eating people's flesh, right? So what happens then? People start getting a little troubled by it. John chapter 6, verse 66. From this time, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. Suddenly, it's getting real, right? Suddenly, Jesus is making statements that aren't just, oh, feel good, hey, it's all one great. Suddenly, it's like, this seems a little bit serious. You do not want to leave too, Jesus asked the 12. Simon Peter answered him, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. We believe and know that you are the Holy One of God. Then Jesus replied, have I not chosen you, the 12? I mean, obviously none of you guys are going to leave. Everyone else may be walking away. But obviously, have I not chosen you, the 12? But one of you is a devil. And we get this image here of Jesus drawing Judas in And here he is, hanging out. He's following Jesus. Everyone else is peeling away, but Judas and the other 12 stick with Jesus day after day as other people are joining and leaving, and here are the apostles staying day after day after day. And what do we do with this? It just doesn't fit. We don't want this to be, I mean, is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? He is handpicked by Jesus, spends 3 years traveling with Jesus. And you can imagine flipping the scenario a little bit different. Imagine you come to Stony Brook, stretch your mind, right? Imagine one day at Stony Brook, somebody stands up and says, one of you is a betrayer and is going to betray God and this church. Now, imagine it's somebody you take seriously, so it's not me, right? But somebody sort of stands up, right, and says it. Jim Cox, right? He stands up. We would all know Jim is serious if he stood up and said this one Sunday morning, right? So in order to this work, you have to imagine you really are, like, this is shocking. What do you instantly start thinking? Jim's just stood up here and said, one of you is a betrayer, and you trust him. He's a trustworthy guy. He's not going to get up and just make some sort of outlandish statement to make a point in the middle of a sermon, right? You really trust him. What do you start thinking? You start thinking, who? And you all start kind of looking around. I've actually already seen you kind of looking around the room, guessing, okay, now who is this person who's the betrayer, right? And I've set this up that you all know, right? And you're all kind of thinking, like, all right, which one of you is the betrayer? You all start kind of running through the possibilities in your mind. Got a lot of people here that it could be, and I don't know. And imagine we forced all of you to take a piece of paper and write down the name of the betrayer. And you'll all instantly say, I can't do this. I don't try to trust all of these people. I mean, none of them could be. But if we forced you all to write down names and turn them in, I dare say we would not have very common names, right? You would all have an impossible time doing this. You'd all come up with random names. There'd be no consent. We don't have the obvious evil person showing up here on a Sunday morning, off to the side, scowling, looking aloof, right? And so we have this odd problem of, you know, here we all are, and we're all kind of looking around saying, who could it be? And we're all sort of trying to figure out, like, none of you seem like betrayers of Christ. None of you seem like the kind of person who would go to the Pharisees and sell out Christ for 30 pieces of silver. That's exactly what the apostles are going through at the Last Supper. None of us seem like likely candidates. Jesus has just announced this, and it's totally bewildering who it could be. And you start running through the possibility, and you're thinking, no, absolutely not. But there's a funny thing about the way we're all thinking about this. Paul talks about it in 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Paul starts telling the story about the Israelites in the Old Testament. And he's telling the story about how the Israelites, they get rescued from Egypt, right? They're in slavery in Egypt. They get rescued by Moses. They're being led across the Red Sea. They go get the Ten Commandments. God himself is there. Pillar of cloud by day, pillar of fire by night. There's God. Here are the Israelites. They're all hanging out with God in the wilderness. And what happens is they're spending day after day after day with God. And you imagine, if we spend day after day after day with God right there, we must. But they're not all good, right? They start betraying God in this way and that way. And, you know, they don't trust about the food and the snakes come and they don't trust that. And they rebel against Moses. And they are constantly rebelling against God. And Paul says this, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 11. These things happened to them as examples and were written down as warnings for us on whom the fulfillment of the ages has come. So if you think you are standing firm, be careful that you do not fall. One of you is going to betray Christ, and you're all immediately thinking around the room, how, who is it? Did you think about yourself as the likely candidate? Did it cross your mind? Maybe it's me. No, I'm standing firm. It must be one of those other people out there that's going to be the betrayer of Christ. And you know what we do? We're just like the Israelites. We're just like Judas. We spend day after day after day with God, and we think, hey, I'm all good. I'm standing firm. The Judases out there, they're the villains. They're the ones that there must be something seriously wrong with them out there. And here we are, day after day, saying, I'm all good here. Judas, the human, betrays Christ. This is really bad. But as you think about this Last Supper scene, who's the good guy in the story? Peter ends up denying Christ 3 times. James and John, along with Peter, in the garden, Jesus says, just keep watch. They fall asleep. All of these apostles abandon Jesus at the end. Every one of them abandons Jesus and flees. 12 for 12. And sure, Judas, that's the worst of the lot. It's way worse to betray Jesus than just sort of run away when he gets arrested. But if you're looking for your role model here, Philip and Nathaniel and Bartholomew aren't doing too well either. In fact, as we think about this Last Supper scene, there's only one really faithful person in the room, and it's Christ himself. And we miss this because we are so hyper-obsessed with watching Judas in the scene. Look back at John chapter 13. What happens in John chapter 13 is so deeply embedded with symbolism, it's sort of stunning, right? Because here we have, Jesus says, one of you is going to betray me. Peter signals John, hey, find out who. John says, who is it? And you imagine what would happen if you were just telling the story. Jesus has to look over at John and say, oh, it's Judas there. Judas is scary. He just could name him right there. He could say, it's him. And he doesn't say, it's Judas Iscariot. But he's not masking who it is. He says, I'm going to do this thing, and exactly what I do, then you'll know. And there's no ambiguity over who he's doing, right? But what does he choose to do to signal it? He takes a piece of bread, and he hands it to Judas. And what's the importance of the piece of bread? The piece of bread, you'll remember, well, Jesus has been standing around saying, I am the bread of life. And then we know from the other Gospels, we talk more about it, Jesus says, you take the bread, this is my body. And so what is Jesus doing here? He's taking the bread, he's taking his body, and he's handing it over to Judas. The symbolism is unmistakable. This is Jesus at a moment saying, I am going to hand myself over to my own betrayer. And he takes the bread and he hands it over. And then what happens? And again, it seems like a throwaway line. Judas leaves. And as soon as Judas had taken the bread, he went out. And it was night. And why is that important? John's gospel starts with, in the beginning and so on, but there is darkness in the world and the light comes into the world. And there's Jesus coming into the world. Jesus hands over his body. And what happens? And it is night. The light of the world is about to be sucked out and crucified on a cross. Jesus here is doing something terribly remarkable. And again, if you're imagining a movie of this sort of thing, if you've watched any mobster movies, you know what happens here, right? Jesus is there, his 12 henchmen, right? And he says, one of you is going to betray me. And he says, it's Judas Iscariot. And what happens? The other 11 are there. It's 11 against one. Judas is swimming with the fishes, right? But Jesus doesn't do that. He could have stopped the betrayal in its tracks. He says, I know Judas is betraying me. We're all sitting in a closed room. I just announced he's betraying me. All I have to do is say the word, and there will be 11 guys who will stop Judas from betraying me without a second's hesitation. And does Jesus do that? Not at all. He hands himself over to be betrayed. The striking thing about this story is not this question of sort of who among us is the betrayer, right? Who is it that's going to betray Christ? The striking thing about the question is Jesus allowing himself to be betrayed. Why is Jesus allowing himself to be betrayed? There are many betrayers among us, right? If I were to say to you, one of you will betray Christ this week, you shouldn't immediately be thinking, who, right? The shocking statement would be, one of you will not betray Christ this week. There's one of you who will stand firm with Christ all week long and never once betray Christ. Imagine I made that statement. Now what are you all thinking? You're thinking, not a possible way that is true. And none of you are suspecting yourself as the person who might get through the whole week without betraying Christ. None of you. That's not surprising that Judas betrays Christ, right? The surprising thing is that Christ allows himself to be betrayed. And why does he do this? We have this whole story here of Judas betraying Christ, and we spend so much time looking at Judas, we miss the real important thing, despite the fact that Jesus goes out of his way to point out the important thing. Judas leaves the room. Jesus continues talking with his disciples, and he says, you know what? I've got an important thing to tell you. I've got a new commandment to give you. And you're imagining this scene. You're imagining, what would Jesus have to say? I mean, you can imagine all sorts of things, like, watch out for people in a church, right? You're in a church, right? There's lots of godly people in a church, right? Don't trust them. right? Because you trust them, they're humans, they're going to fail. There's only one person we should be trusting, it's Christ himself. We could say that, and it would be a great message. It would be a really important message. We shouldn't be following human leaders. We need to constantly keep our eyes on Christ. But that's not what Jesus says. He could say, you know what? Here are all the signs. This is how you should have noticed it was Judas. And there had to be something. He doesn't say that. Jesus says this. I've got one command for you. John chapter 13, verse 34. A new command I give you. You can imagine, we're all hanging. What's the new command? Love one another. Which is great, because that's a new command. I mean, it seems like a fairly old command. Love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. That's new. How much has Christ loved us? He's loved on us enough to sit there and allow himself to be betrayed. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. This is the message at the end that Jesus is pointing out. He's pointing out at the scene of the Last Supper and the betrayal of Jesus, don't concentrate on Judas, concentrate on me, Christ. This is about Christ, and it's about Christ's love. It's about Christ's willingness to go to the cross and die for all of you betrayers of Christ, and here he is, he's going to show love to all of you, and then his command is, you should all go out and show love for each other, just like Christ showed love for you.